At the age of 29, New Yorker Carrie Sun bagged a top job at a Wall Street hedge fund, a private assistant to the firm's billionaire founder. She was immersed in a world of power, privilege and extreme wealth. But as the demands exacted a toll on her physical and mental health, she started to question everything she'd worked so hard for. Her memoir, Private Equity, exposes the brutal reality of high finance. And I asked Carrie, as she'd already worked in that field, where was she at when she got the job?
I was feeling just lost in life. I was 29 years old at the time, and I had a lot of self-doubt. And I felt really ambivalent about the industry of finance. You know, I worked in it, but I really sort of felt disconnected from a lot of it. And I was feeling afloat. And so when this recruiter reached out to me with this opportunity to be the right-hand person to this hedge fund billionaire, it was definitely very interesting on paper. You know, I knew it would probably be well compensated. So not only was I able to have a day job, but I was hoping to make back some of the my savings that I had been burning through. And more importantly, it gave me an immediate sense of just direction, you know, fully make the career change that I really wanted to do, even when I was 29.
Mm. And even just getting the job was quite an ordeal in itself. Was it 11 or
yes.
14 interviews that you went through?
Yes, 14 interviews from, you know, the recruiter. And just speaking to the recruiter, I had a resume screen, a phone call, an in-person interview with him before I, you know, he even told me about the job. Then after he told me about the job and he pitched me to that company, the person on that company side handling the recruiting asked me to come in person in 2 hours. So, you know, that just speaks to kind of the pace at which things happen in that world. And there is just not a second to be wasted at all.
And you had an IQ and a personality test done as part of this by the company that you didn't get to see the results of.
Yes. So, you know, it's very interesting because they have a very well-known, as you say, just personality and IQ test. And, you know, part of the process, I was actually surprisingly not subjected to that because I think maybe it was more tailored to just people on the investment side. Although, you know, as I detail in my book, I did do plenty of investment, just research for my boss. But I got to take a look at everyone else's scores, and it was top secret information. I didn't tell anyone, you know, how they did, but that kind of testing of both the psychology and the intellect of workers, you know, and then the kind of asymmetry of information between what your employer knows about you and what they're not willing to share that they know about you. I just think it's such a perfect metaphor for kind of this imbalance and asymmetry that exists in workplaces today.
Mm. You get the job though, and the job is at an extraordinary place with amazing perks. Just run us through some of what you encountered in your first days and weeks as regards the world that this person, that these people lived in.
Yes. As you say, the perks were so fantastic that I thought it was like fantastical, as in truly like not of this world. You know, we have a stipend for lunch every day, including catered lunch from the very best restaurants in New York. The kitchen was stocked like Whole Foods. You know, every single flavor of kombucha and, you know, just all these like health foods. More than that, there was the gym. It overlooked Central Park. There was also a yoga and bar room for floor exercise. There was a Peloton overlooking Central Park. Again, you can watch sunrises and sunsets. And in the gym, there were endless new Lululemon and Nike workout apparel for anyone who needed to work out. You never needed to bring your workout clothes. And then when you're done, you throw them in a hamper. Work will launder them for you. You never had to leave your desk to go downstairs to pick up your lunch. There were runners who would bring it straight up to, you know, high up in the skyscraper directly to your desk. So you never actually had to leave. Yeah, the perks were just absolutely incredible.
And there was also someone to flush the toilets.
Yes. Even though the toilets are auto flush, but the auto flush, you know, you have to kind of stick around for, I don't know, 3 seconds, 5 seconds to see if the auto flush worked. And often, you know, in this relentlessly fast paced environment in which every second had to be utilized and optimized, you know, I think perhaps many of the workers in the front office, the men, the investment staff, didn't have the patience to wait those seconds to see if the toilet auto flushed and then, you know, push down on the button to make sure it flushed. And then the way our office at the time solved the problem was to hire a woman whose entire job was to wait in the unisex bathroom hall every day and make sure every toilet was not only flushed after each use, but clean.
Tell me a little bit about the person that you call Boone Prescott in the book. That's not his real name, but your boss.
Yes.
And
yes.
his attitudes, because this idea of, you know, money can fix almost anything, that came from him, didn't it?
Yes. My education was that actually he's quite correct. Most of the time, having more money can just, you know, fix problems. And I quickly learned that, like, money was not the constraint in this world. Everything was around time. And the budget was always a budget of time and not of money. And I had just so much respect for him when I started the job, because he was someone who really cared about morality and ethics. He expressed as much on the firm level, on the personal level, and, you know, on the philanthropic level. He tried hard to really be as generous and as fair as possible. You know, I was burnt out within the first, like, I would say 3 months. I started to get burnt out, but, you know, still kept on going because I really believed in what he was saying, that he really cared for my career and wanted to help me succeed.
You mentioned that you were burnt out probably about 3 months into this 2.5 year job, but what was your workload like? How much were you meant to be doing every day?
You know, on my very first day of work, I received my written job description, and it listed nearly 100 bullet points of responsibilities. Those responsibilities can be make sure you communicate the entire schedule, my boss's entire schedule, to the home office so that, you know, his family office, his wife and his kids will all know where he is at any given point in time, so everyone else can plan. No unanswered phones at the office. That meant that to have no incoming calls go to voicemail. And that was really stressful, because at certain times I was talking to three people on the phone at the same time, you know, different people on hold for different reasons. And the quantity is high, but what concerns me is also the quality of those responsibilities. And by that, I mean, many of those responsibilities include the term as needed, as necessary. And here's the thing, is that as needed and as necessary speaks to, I think, this problem of work being so unpredictable now in knowledge intensive jobs. So you start your day and you have no idea what your day will be like, what tasks you will be doing, what kind of methods and processes you will be needing to use for the completion of those tasks, the time required, you know. And another version of this is just being on call. You don't know the time required. And then you also don't know the expectations. So the work was, the workload was extreme, plenty, unrelenting, and also unpredictable. And so, you know, it wasn't every Friday night I was working, but if I get an email from my boss Friday night at 11 p.m., I'll need to stop doing whatever I'm doing, go find my, laptop and computer, and if it's not with me, I'll have to go home and then sign on to the work laptop so I can then VPN to my work desktop to answer a question of his, and so that is really the unpredictability and the kind of nature of the work that really led to my burnout.
And it was a toxic productivity. It was about doing. It was all about efficiency. But efficiency to
Yes.
what end?
So because they are an investment firm, they are a hedge fund, but they also have private equity investments and venture capital, but just overall an investment firm, the efficiency was really to squeeze every ounce of return possible for their investors, for their limited partners who invest in their funds, both on the hedge fund side and the venture fund side. So there was this extreme focus on return on time. So every 5 seconds you're doing, like, how is this adding to the firm's profits, bottom line? It was always about how to do more work during the day so that the work can bring about more returns. So whether that be making an investment decision earlier rather than later, and so that also speaks to the pace of investing. Just the pace of everything was just faster and faster because, to your exact question, to what end was this efficiency for? The end was to be able to make more investment decisions quicker, hopefully without sacrificing quality. And if you can make those decisions quicker, hopefully you might be able to start compounding those returns and seeing those returns in your portfolios sooner.
To the point that you were literally run off your feet.
I was. So after my very first day of work, my boss had emailed me a photo of his kids. The next day at work, I didn't respond because the email was something at like 8 or 9 p.m. To me, it was on a personal topic, and I really wanted to respond fully in person where I could express to him how, touched I was by the photo and how cute I found his kids, really. And before I could even say that, he called me into his office and asked me, "Did you get my email last night?" And then it was quickly very clear to me he wanted me to respond to all of his emails as soon as I saw them. So that's code for immediately. And he wanted me to respond to all emails with just a "got it" because he wants to know that I saw his email. So that led me to 6 months into my job. I'm on the treadmill, and halfway through the run, I get an email from my boss or a text. I can't actually remember. My phone dings, and a ding tells me it's from him. I see it's not time sensitive. I tell myself I can wait 30 minutes to respond. But then I'm having this argument with myself back and forth where I'm like, well, he already criticized me once and gave me immediate feedback that I have to respond to his emails and anything he tells me immediately. Well, so after a few minutes of this back and forth, I decide, well, I don't want to stop my run. I want to continue running because it's really important for my sanity to complete this one small goal that I made for myself 30 minutes ago. So I answer the email while running, and I pick up my phone, I start typing a reply, and I immediately fall off the treadmill. And it was a big fall. I had extreme treadmill burns, both on the palms of my hands, like everywhere, all my joints hurt. And really, I think the term I use, phrase I use in my book is quilts of skin were missing from my knees. And it took my knees, the skin on my knees, many, many, many months to heal. And I still have scars from that today.
Because you didn't go to the hospital straight away. Because you didn't have
No.
time.
Exactly. Well, the first thing I said after I fell off the treadmill was, "I'm fine." And then the second thought I had, which I didn't say out loud, was, "I need to get back to work." All I could think about was how my treadmill fall would be affecting my ability to do my work.
Some of the feedback that you got from Boone, from your boss, seemed pretty astonishing. I suppose I'm thinking in particular things like, around the time you told him you were on a juice cleanse, but he seemed to kind of step over a line quite a lot.
Yes, and I think, not to be defending him, but I think his intention with those comments, he thinks he's helping me. He thinks he's helping me be the best version of myself. And his helping is always trying to push me to do more, do better, be more intense. And after we, he really egged me on to do, he said, see if you can do another week. And so I think that moment really just kind of symbolizes unending, ceaseless pushing that we, I think, across society feel at work, where when you actually complete a task, it isn't good job, or rarely is it good job, but it's how can you do more? But I think in my book, I am asking the question, like, where is the limit? What is the limit? Can you push someone to such a limit that, you know, the job itself is actually impossible and your workload is inhuman, and you're really asked to be superhuman at your job.
Susie Ferguson with you this morning on Saturday morning here on RNZ National. My guest is Carrie Sun. We're talking about her first book. It is a memoir. It is called Private Equity, which traverses aspects of her life, including how she took a job as a personal assistant to a billionaire. How much part of the scene, the financial scene, was this kind of behaviour? And also the vast inequality, the waste that you would see in the office. Is that just part of the
Yes.
scene?
Yes. The names I use in the book are pseudonyms. And the reason I chose to do that was because I didn't want to center the book on anyone else's story or any specific firm or specific person. It's my story. And the actual names of the individuals are not important because I think this type of both behavior and attitude is representative of the industry.
You write about your boss being nice. You talk about him being nice several times in the book. But did he also exploit you? Was it a coercive, controlling relationship? Because it comes across as one.
I chose to write this book primarily as a documentation of my changing consciousness and gradual dawning awareness of what was happening. So now, with the benefit of hindsight, I don't think that he was trying to explicitly exploit me. However, we had an exploitative relationship because I think this just gets back into actually capitalism. Capitalism is all about unequal social relations and the capitalist logic of that unequal social relation, and how it, also with hindsight now, I can't believe how low my bar was for what nice means. You know, my boss never yelled at me. He did critique and criticize me a lot and give me instant feedback all the time, and including feedback on things that, you know, were not directly related to work. But I just thought he was really nice because he just never raised his voice. And easy definition of nice that I no longer have, but I thought I had it good, actually, because I hear stories. I mean, I actually saw at this firm of my peers' assistants sort of crying at their jobs. And you know, I was like, I felt lucky that my boss never made me cry.
There's an interesting point in the book, I think towards the end, where you talk about how your reading of The Handmaid's Tale at school was very different to some of your classmates. And I wonder how much your childhood set you up for this situation, for the opportunity, but not the freedom. How do you view that?
When I started the job, I think this line is in the book. I say something like, I felt like I was born to do this. So the environment in which I grew up is very, very similar to my working environment at this job. They are both systems of domination. And by that, I mean, you know, when I was a child, my parents had really all the power, alienated workers who might be alienated perhaps from their childhood, at like I was. Alienated workers make the best workers because they might not know that they were being exploited. They will just want to work. They will be on this forever treadmill of seeking external validation because they might be disconnected from their internal sense of self and sense of self-worth. And I really wanted to show those two interlocking systems of both my home environment and my work environment. And as you said earlier, the phrase opportunities but not freedom, I felt like I had so many opportunities. I never truly felt free until I quit my two jobs at two different hedge funds and really embarked on the path that I wanted to go on, which was enroll in an MFA, complete my MFA, and write my first book.
You wanted to be a writer. You told Boone that you wanted to be a writer, and he said that you wouldn't be because you were too much of a doer. Just briefly, I guess, what challenges were there to writing this particular story? Because I would imagine there'll be NDAs all over the place.
There were many challenges. And so the challenge was just really to think about what is the story I'm telling and just to only tell that story because I feel like I have a right, and not just me, but any worker, any average worker has a right to tell his or her own story of their working conditions. And then just coming to terms with the person I was in the book, which is very different from who I am now. And I kind of, when I started writing the book, I really had a very difficult time, and just I was just embarrassed, ashamed at how naive I was. But I think I had to get over that because that is the story.